All right, so let's go to chapter 2, which is called The Chemical Context of Life. This is the first normal chapter, in a sense, because it doesn't jump all around. It's about chemistry, and that shouldn't surprise you, because I told you that this whole class is just as much a chemistry course as biology, because biology at the cellular level is all about chemistry. And the opening slide here gives you an example of a chemical reaction using pictures to indicate a chemical reaction equation. A chemical reaction equation has an arrow to separate two important sets of substances. The substances on the left side of the arrow, which are there's two of in this example, it can be any number. But anyway, on the left side of the arrow in a chemical reaction, you have reactants. The substances that you start with before the reaction occurs, in other words, can be one or more things. However many things are on the right side, and one in this case, but it doesn't have to be one, are the products. Products are so called because they get produced. In other words, in any given chemical reaction, you have a change in substance. Something gets transformed into something else, a different substance. You have different stuff with different properties, even though nothing is added or taken away materially in a chemical reaction. All materials are made out of atoms. And in a chemical reaction, you have the atoms that the reactants are made out of to begin with. Well, you have exactly those same atoms in the products. That's what I mean by nothing is added or subtracted from the situation. It's the same stuff, it's just that the particles get rearranged. And that rearrangement of particles makes a big difference, or it can. This is a good example of how big a difference that can make. In this specific example, you have sodium as one of the reactants, and sodium is a metal, but it's a very highly reactive and dangerous metal, which is why you would never want to touch pure sodium. It will violently react with the little bit of moisture in your skin, explosively react. Sodium will easily kill you, in other words, is what I'm saying, by itself. Nothing you want to be around, which is why he's wearing gloves. Chlorine is a poisonous gas by itself. It also will kill you. Very highly reactive, which is why we use it to disinfect things like a pool. It kills things, in other words. So neither one of these reactants is anything you want to be around by itself. But if you get these two deadly things together, the atoms that they're made out of will rearrange, and it will create a new substance, sodium chloride, which is one of many salts, but it's usually what we mean when we say salt. Table salt is specifically sodium chloride. And that's a big change, because not only will sodium chloride not kill you, but you cannot live without it. So you've changed two deadly things into an indispensable thing, just with a simple rearrangement of particles. That's actually pretty amazing. Usually we don't use pictures like this. We usually use symbols. And in slide 2, we have a different chemical reaction. This one reaction, but shown two different ways. One's with, instead of photographs, it's showing cartoons. But the normal way is on the bottom with chemical formulae, just symbols. But the cartoon is nice here because it shows you in pictures what I was just talking about. There is no addition of atoms or subtraction of atoms. It's the same atoms beginning and ending, but they've rearranged how they are joined with each other. All right, so hydrogen gas, oxygen gas become water. That's the reaction occurring here. And water has properties that are totally different from the properties of either one of the reactants. Now we can go to 3. The table we're looking at, as you see, is about the human body. But these numbers wouldn't be very different if you talked about any given organism, really. So I wish they hadn't done it for the humans, because it's really a universal thing that any given organism is made out or contains certain elements. We therefore better define elements. An element is a substance, but not all substances are elements. In fact, the vast majority of substances are not elements. What is it that makes a substance an element? Yeah. That's right, but by purely, what is meant there is that an element is made up of only one kind of atom. Doesn't matter how many there are, trillions and trillions of them, but they're all the same kind of atom in that sample. There are millions, I mean, there's no limit to the number of substances. We've already produced millions of different chemicals. But even though there is no limit to that, there is a kind of a surprisingly small number of elements. They're all listed in the periodic table of the elements. There's only roughly 100 elements. And all those millions so far, and no limit to the number of substances produced, they are just collections of the elements. So, as far as substances are concerned, there are elements. Each one contains only one kind of atom. But if you have a sample that contains multiple kinds of atoms, like water, it has an oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms, that's two different kinds of atoms, then you don't have an element anymore, you have a compound. Sodium chloride, in that opening example, is an example of a compound. Sodium is an element, chlorine is an element, but they react to form a compound. And so with this 100 or so elements, there's no limit to the number of compounds you can make. But organisms, even though there are roughly 100 elements, most organisms do not want to have most of these elements in their body. Almost all organisms contain mostly these elements toward the top of the table, which are the smaller elements, because this thing is arranged in terms of size of the atoms that make up the elements. And there's a whole list of elements for any given organism that organism requires to remain alive. But in terms of actual numbers of the atoms that are in the body of the organism, these first four make up the bulk of the organism. Carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen are the four biggies. All organisms contain those four. And then there are a bunch of other elements that are needed. You'll die without them, but you not only don't need much, just trace amounts, but too much can be bad in a lot of cases. When you get down to the heavy stuff, that's something you don't want to have anywhere in your body. Yes. Let's go to 4 then and talk about atoms. Now, when we talked about the hierarchy of biological organization, I started at the level of atom. But atoms are not fundamental particles, meaning they are not the smallest particles. As inconceivably tiny as atoms are made of even smaller things, which, because they're smaller than atoms, are called subatomic particles. And in this course, we're going to concern ourselves only with 3 categories of subatomic particles. If you go on to study deeper, you'll see that even these subatomic particles I'm going to talk about are made of even smaller things. But then you're out of the realm of biology. So these are the ones that are important for us today. The three categories of subatomic particles are electrons, neutrons, and protons. And each of these categories has only one type in it. In other words, there aren't different types of electrons. All electrons are pretty much identical. Same for all neutrons, same for all protons. So what distinguishes those categories? Well, a neutron gets its name because it is neutral with respect to electrical charge. It does not have an electrical charge. So it is neutral. That's in opposition to a proton, which, to look at them, they're obviously not really magenta and brown. That's a cartoon. If you were to actually somehow able to get in there and look at one proton and one neutron, you would might mistake them for each other, because even though they're not identical in mass and therefore size, they are almost identical in mass, neutrons and protons. So what's the difference? Well, electrical charge. A neutron has no electrical charge. A proton does have an electrical charge, and it specifically has a positive one charge. Each individual proton is positive one. Electrons, on the other hand, are different and very easy to distinguish from the other size-wise. Electrons are much smaller than the already tiny protons and neutrons. And you can, this is one reason why this is a lie. This is not the truth, but it's the cartoon is useful for other reasons anyway. One lie about this, though, is that the electrons are shown here much bigger than they actually would be compared to the size of the neutrons and protons.
Would it be like X or dots?
Yeah. Yes, if it was real. So an electron, though, is not only much smaller than a proton and a neutron, it also is electrically charged, but in the opposite direction. Electrons are negatively charged. And despite the huge size difference between a charged electron and a charged proton, the size of the charges is equal. So an electron is a full negative one, which is just as big but in the opposite direction as a positive one of a proton, even though they're drastically different sizes. So if you have one of each, an electron and a proton, the charges cancel each other out, and overall you don't have any charge. And you can add zero or more neutrons, and that doesn't affect the charge either, because they don't have charge to begin with. Okay? In any given atom, you have what is called the atomic nucleus, which is a completely different use of the word nucleus compared to cell nucleus. A cell nucleus contains millions of atoms. It's much bigger than an atomic nucleus. But the nucleus is the core of the atom. And what defines the nucleus is that is the where, and it's the only place, that you'll find the protons, however many there are, that atom contains. If you don't have at least one proton, then you don't have an atom. An atom features one or more protons. An atom does not have to contain any neutrons, but most do. And if there are neutrons, however many there are, all of them will be in the nucleus as well. In other words, for any given atom, the nucleus contains all of the protons, one or more, and all of the neutrons, zero or more. You won't find protons and neutrons outside of the nucleus. Conversely, you won't find electrons in the nucleus. You'll find them only somewhere around the nucleus. And somewhere is the important word here, because it turns out that we can't actually predict where exactly any individual electron is at any moment. This is another reason why this is a lie, by the way. This is a so-called orbital diagram, where the electrons are kind of like planets orbiting the nucleus. That's actually not what happens. This yellow circle is a lie. But despite it not being true, it's kind of good to have that in your head, just to remind you of where these subatomic particles are.
Like what's in or not in the nucleus.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. A less of a lie is shown in slide 5. Now, the part B is the same lie as I just showed you. Part A is less of a lie. It shows you the same nucleus, but it doesn't show any discrete electrons. Instead, it just shows a cloud of yellowness that represents a probability space. It's a space around the nucleus where the electrons could be at any given moment, but we can't tell. We can, though, compute where they are more likely to be than other places. And that's represented by the yellowness. Notice that it fades off to lighter and lighter yellow as you go. It's less likely for an electron to be out here in the less yellow part. Now, we talked about elements already a little bit, and I told you that an element contains only one kind of atom. That phrase suggests that there are different kinds of atoms, which is true, there are. But I also told you that there isn't such thing as different kinds of electrons or different kinds of protons or different kinds of neutrons. So there are different kinds of atoms, but not because there are different kinds of subatomic particles. What makes atoms different kinds, and therefore examples of different elements, is that they have different numbers of protons. And not the other kinds. Protons only. The periodic table lists all of the elements, and they list them in order of what is called atomic number, which in this version is the blue integer. The atomic number is always the number of protons found in that kind of atom. Hydrogen is therefore the simplest possible atom, because it has exactly one proton. That is the only thing that makes it a hydrogen atom. The fact that it has exactly one proton. It doesn't matter at all how many of the other subatomic particles it has. The proton defines the element. Helium has two, and so on. But the last thing I'll say for now is that when we use the word atom, we usually are assuming by the word atom that we're talking about a neutral atom, electrically neutral. And if that's true, then for it to be electrically neutral, that atom has to have exactly as many electrons as it has protons. Protons make it the element. So helium is helium only because it has two protons. But if it is a neutral atom of helium, therefore it must also have two electrons to counteract the two positive charges of the protons. All right, we'll stop there.